Good morning, lovelies. It is actually a beautiful day in Chicago, and thank goodness because this week is finals week. Not sure if I would survive it if it wasn't beautiful outside. Hello, and welcome back to Diddy and Hawthorne in the In-Between. I'm your host, Mackenzie Gentz, and you're listening to my podcast about the relevancy of literature in the 21st century. Now, bookmark that book, and let's begin. Today's book is Play It As It Lays by Joan Didion, my fifth Joan Didion book that I've ever read. I think I have 11 or 12 more to get through before the year is over, but we're making good progress. First of all, I want to make an apology. I did not post an episode last week in lieu of Labor Day. I should have let you all know sooner instead of anticipating that I would make an episode last minute, which never works out, as we all can relate to, I'm sure. I did finish my research paper though, which was an exciting conclusion to probably over 70 or 80 hours of reading about churches in Nuremberg. So, today for our discussion, I wanted to do something a bit different in that I'm going to be ad-libbing, not reading from a script, in other words. And I'm doing this for a few reasons. Some of it is the time that I usually take to make a script is used for studying for finals this week, and some of it is that I do need to get better at immediately responding to some of your questions because I feel like I have loads and loads of questions that just take me too long to get through oftentimes. So we have some discussion questions today that I've just written bullet notes out for, and I'm going to ad lib on some of those, and let's get into it. So Play It As It Lays, Joan Didion, it's one of her first books that really hit it big. It was written in 1970. The New York Times called it one of the most influential books between the 1970s and the early 2000s in the English language, and it's one of her only fiction books that she's written. She's written four or five others, but most of her collective works are actually nonfiction, which is interesting. And there's this quote, I guess our first question actually is Play It As It Lays autobiographical? Very interesting question because there's this quote from the director that directed this famous movie, Bicycle Thieves, and he said that the best actor is the one who plays himself. And I think that's similar a lot of times to writers, where to the extent that any of her novels are fiction, this novel is fiction. She, at this time even, has already lived through a lot of trauma and death and suffering, which was heightened by her mental illness. And she was known to be very ill, like the main character Mariah. The main character's name is actually spelled Maria, pronounced Mariah, just FYI. So it seems that to the extent that any of her novels are fiction, again, this seems to be fiction. There are just so many parallels to Didion's life, though. And as I was reading, I would get caught on certain lines and say, "Oh, that's strikingly familiar," because I've actually only read her nonfiction books, so this was my first deep dive into a fiction book of hers, and it was quite an amazing experience. It was a really wonderful read. I read this in like 4 days because I just couldn't put it down. I kept grabbing for it, almost on impulse. And in addition, I think Maria's relationship to her daughter, as well as her representation of, again, mental illness in general, specifically were the things that caught me as familiar. Mariah has this daughter, Kate, that's in a mental hospital, and she has this connection to Kate that is unlike any other that has been forged in literature, really. And she, just the amount that she obsesses over and pines for Kate, the amount that she feels she needs to take care of Kate, even though she can't really even take care of herself. There's this feeling throughout that, Kate, this is my child. There's nothing else in this world. That feeling is definitely present in Didion's autobiographical works. And Mariah's mental illness is quite interesting as well because she has, in the middle of the book, by the way, this episode will be full of spoilers, I'm sure. In the middle of the book, her husband Carter convinces her to get an abortion because she is pregnant with someone else's child, and he threatens to take Kate away, so she buckles down and gets the abortion. It's an incredibly traumatic experience for her, and the scene is rather disturbing, and she goes to this motel in Encino with the doctor, and he, you know, makes her drive to the location, and they meet in front of what is essentially a Kmart to do the procedure. And it's the whole book thereafter is mediated by these threads of disillusionment, these threads of hallucinatory. She thinks that she sees, or that there are little placentas or little infants in the drains or in the ocean. She pictures them like jellyfish at a certain point in the ocean, where she imagines Kate and her living one day. And so it's partly heightened, this representation of mental illness, by the traumatic experience that she is seemingly forced to go through, and then again heightened by this intense love that she has for her daughter. She also uses the same prose style, interestingly, in her fiction as she does in her nonfiction. And I think that's why, we'll get into this in a later question, but she was thinking about initially doing the whole novel in a first-person perspective, but most of it is actually in a third-person with little interruptions of first-person. And I think that the similarity of prose style was one of the things that made her say, okay, this is getting too close to home, I need to do some of this in a more detached narrative form. The second question, what tense is the book written in? What style, and how does that affect how the book is read? So, like I just said, it's mostly written in third person, actually, and it has little interruptions of first person, which is very interesting because it's almost like Didion couldn't compromise. It's almost like she wanted to write the book in first person. And there were several interviews that are mentioned in the foreword, actually, where Didion goes into this in more depth. But where she wanted to write the whole thing in first person, and she was saying, okay, I couldn't find the right first person to settle into that was going to be a whole book's long. So she decided to distance herself a little bit with little glimpses of Mariah's actual consciousness throughout. And I think this is a really smart decision because she has this cyclic representation of grief throughout the whole book. And what's traumatizing about it is that it's so unrelenting in the entire novel. And I think part of what makes it breathable at points is this narrative shift. And so how does this affect how the book is read? Well, for me, when I was reading it, I would often get to a place where she would have a shorter chapter, maybe with Mariah narrating, and then these, you know, 10 or 12 page chapters with the third person, and I'd say, okay, after, you know, Mariah's section, I can take a break, I can think about it. And I often read before bed as well, so finding that little space to breathe and think about the narrative and how it's changing is really amazing. And also the pacing differs between the different narrative styles, so that was something that was really cool. When you're going through, you can pause and you can dissect little bits of information based on how fast or slow the pacing is. Another thing that I kind of mentioned before that I love about this book is that she does these little paragraph chapters, and this the first time I saw this kind of style actually was when I went and read Kurt Vonnegut's collective works, especially in Kurt Vonnegut's newer slash the novels he wrote when he was older, like Jailbird, for example. He uses this sort of punch of a chapter. Sometimes his chapters are even one line or one word, in order to differentiate certain messages from the bulk of the text. So he'll have one word, maybe he has a lot of catchphrases throughout his books, like "So It Goes," for example, in Slaughterhouse-Five, and so just to make up an example, he would characteristically write a single chapter just saying, "So it goes," and that would be the only thing your eyes rest on in that whole page for a moment. And that instills this message into your psyche as you continue to read the book. And so that's sort of on the forefront of your mind, and you go into the next chapter or the next section of the book with a totally different idea of how to start reading it. Didian does the same thing, and oftentimes what's interesting is that she has Mariah's perspective as the short punchy chapters, meaning that she wants you to continue on with the book with Mariah's perspective in mind and with her ideas and with her control in mind. Another thing about the shortness of the chapters, I think, is the disillusionment that they show. Kurt Vonnegut especially, he's a postmodern writer, just like Don DeLillo. Don DeLillo, I think he does really short chapters sometimes too, maybe in Mao 2, which I read recently. He shows his disillusionment through them, because writing, you know, was this highbrow, amazing profession at even at the time that Vonnegut was writing in the 60s, you know, getting something published in Playboy magazine even was such a feat. And he showed his disillusionment by breaking conventional rules and by writing chapters with one word in them and saying, "This is my art, accept my art, and respect the way that I want to do this, even if it's unconventional." And as well, this book, to tie it back to Play It As It Lays, this book is so much about disillusionment. This book is so much about how Hollywood is a sham and how it disrupts people and how Mariah is so much worse off because she's a part of this culture and a part of this scene than she would be otherwise. And I think that the chapters, especially as they are in Mariah's viewpoint, just really hit home how disenchanted Didion is with the whole Hollywood charade. Something that makes modern books different from older books, and we all know I love classics. I've read mostly classics in the last few years, and I'm just getting into modern fiction, but something that's interesting is that the short chapters and the way that these books are written in form makes finding the narrative threads an engaging process. So not so that the plot and that the storyline isn't spoon-fed to you, because oftentimes in older novels the writing style is in itself a barrier to your understanding of the plot or of what the characters are thinking. So here the barrier is the form. So that's why it's so cool to read this kind of literature, is because the writing itself isn't what's difficult to understand, it's the way that things are situated. Individual chapters or sections are very easy to read, but putting those into the grand scheme of the book, whether it be because she jumps around between past and present, or because she jumps around between Mariah's thoughts and the omniscient narrator's descriptions, that's what makes it difficult. Question 3, dissect some of your favorite quotes. I have two favorite quotes. I have probably 24 little quotes that I have dog-eared in this book. It was stunning, quite frankly. I personally, in my own prose style, I've become very, my sentences have become incredibly long, and they are grammatically correct oftentimes, but I can write a 200-word sentence no problem. And what I loved about this book was its simplicity. So my first quote comes on page 124. I have the Farrar, Straus, and Giroux version of the book. I think this is one of the only versions available, actually, but let me know in the comments if you guys have a different version. Page 124, chapter 47. "You're lying in the water," the hypnotist said. "You're lying in the water, and it's warm, and you hear your mother's voice." "No," Mariah said, "I don't." The hypnotist stood up. He always seemed cold, and he was always sipping Pernod and water, and his house was dusty and cluttered with torn newspaper clippings and stained file folders. "What do you hear?" he said finally. "What do you hear and see in your mind right now? What are you doing?" "I'm driving over here," Maria said. "I'm driving Sunset and I'm staying in the left lane because I can see the New Havana Ballroom and I'm going to turn left at the New Havana Ballroom. That's what I'm doing." I love this quote because I think what I love about a lot of her little punchy sections like this one is that it adds a necessary bit of humor. It's almost a sort of breathing room again in the novel. This is so funny. She's in the book, plot-wise, she sees an advertisement for a hypnotist in the newspaper that can supposedly make you revert back to your state in the womb. And she says, "Yep, that's it for me. I'm gonna go visit him." And she visits him for a while, periodically throughout the book, but he doesn't do anything for her. And she is so, again, just solid, and she's so disenchanted with the whole process, and she thinks that it's such a sham. But at the same time, she continues to go for quite some time. I think she does 3 or 4 sessions. So this is what's interesting to me, is that she knows she's in pain, she knows she's very ill, and she calls people throughout the book and says, "I need help, I'm very ill," and yet she doesn't do anything about it. And that's the kind of thing, and even though the passage at face value is funny, she doesn't use humor as a breath of fresh air in her own life. She uses it more so as a byproduct of her intense pain, and I think that's what's really beautiful about that passage, at least. The next passage is page 192. I'm trying to find a good place to start. Mariah leaned back on Helena's bed. "I'm tired of Harrison." She licked the inside of her glass and let the bourbon coat her tongue. "Some ice might help." "The refrigerator's broken. Roll a number." Mariah closed her eyes. "And I'm also tired of Susanna." "What else are you tired of?" "I don't know." "You're getting there," BZ said. "Getting where?" "Where I am." I thought this passage was so witty when I first read it. Granted, it was probably quite late at night, but just the way that BZ actually is supposedly a major character in the novel. He doesn't appear as often as I think that the movie adaptation of this book portrays him as, but he, just in this short section, he's presented as such a character, and he's presented as someone who takes the dice and rolls them. Or in other words, he sees Mariah as she is, and he is not taking any of her BS. And that's, this bit of characterization, I think, is really golden, and there are very little instances of things that she does like this, where she takes little bits of dialogue and throws them for a loop. Especially when he says, "You're getting there," and she says, "Getting where?" and he says, "Where I am." It's a play on words, right? As a linguist, I see there as a specific place, like a physical location, and that's obviously what Mariah took that as, and he's saying, "No, you're getting to the state where I am." And I just think that's brilliant. Those little things that you can pull in, and he's, if you're a linguist, you know that he's not following the cooperative principle here, Grace's maxims and all of that. Our last question today is, what is the point in reading an obviously sad, depressive novel? This is the one that I get a lot, especially because the last book that I finished before this actually was Lolita, which is crazy to me because that was a while ago, and I usually get through books pretty quick, but I've been reading Infinite Jest and a 600-page documentation called Kaddish by Wieseltier, and also, I think, a 1,000-page biography on Richard Nixon, so I there's a reason why I haven't finished a book in quite some time. But yeah, I tend to gravitate towards these really depressive, awful books. And what's interesting is that I feel like I'm a generally very happy person, a very content person, and that may be because of some of my philosophies. You can go back to the last episode that we did about minimalism to hear more about that, but I think oftentimes that this representation of grief and this representation of utter sadness, utter despair, Mariah is not a happy person, and it is a lot about, especially when reading authors like Didion, it is a lot about being able to live in the headspace of someone that is so discontented and so broken and so hurt. And that's what's beautiful about it, is that you're able to experience someone else's loss and their conception of grief and their conception of sadness for however many pages the novel is, in this case a little over 200. And you're able to funnel that and mediate it into your own life in a way that hopefully, if not prepares you for when, you know, sad things do happen, allows you to remember that you're not alone and allows you to understand that grief and sadness and loss and things like this are part of the human condition rather than something that alienates you from everyone else. And I think artistic representations of these kinds of states are ultimately what allows us to continue creating, especially if you're an artist yourself. I'm an artist myself, so reading really depressive, really intense things like this. I'm reading a book about letters from Rilke right now about his grief and loss to other people. That helps me feel like I can understand another person's conception of grief, and I can use that to funnel into my own art and my own creating of all of these states, especially in music. So that is the end of the episode. I hope you enjoyed Play It As It Lays. I certainly did. I would absolutely recommend this novel to people who feel like they have a week to just read 200 pages. It's one and done, really. It's a read that you can definitely read in one sitting if you have a free afternoon. I will be on next week with more literature. I don't know what I'm writing about yet, honestly. I don't know what I'll be talking about yet, but we will start getting into more analyses as my school year wraps up. So that is all. Have a wonderful week, y'all, and I will see you on Monday. If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from me, there is an episode of DH&I for everyone, so I'd recommend checking out our back catalog of episodes. 2019 is the year of Didion, so if you'd like to follow along in my quest to read Joan Didion's collective works or learn more about the movement to bring lit back to people, everything can be found at didionandhawthorne.blueberry.net, and remember that blueberry is spelled B-L-U-B-R-R-Y. Now you can also follow the show on Twitter with @DidionIn, 2 N's total. I'll be posting about new lit releases, reading lists, and of course the new projects and episodes relating to DH&I. Still there? One more thing then. Remember that leaving a comment or a review on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or any other Guilty Pleasure podcast platform helps leverage the show so that other literature enthusiasts can find the community. In other words, it helps a ton. Auf Wiederhören!